Craft matters in small ways, like how coffee is made or how a wooden table is built piece by piece. And in not so small ways, like how your money is cared for. At UBS, we elevate investing to a craft. We deliver our services with passion, expertise, and meticulous attention to detail. This is what investing means to UBS. Not just work, but a craft. Discover more at ubs.com/craft. The value of investments may fall as well as rise, and you may not get back the amount originally invested.
How do you satirize Hollywood's treatment of Asian Americans in a novel? Charles Yu will be here to talk about his National Book Award winner, Interior Chinatown. Who is the last American aristocrat? David S. Brown will join us to talk about his new biography of Henry Adams. Alexander Alter will have an update from the publishing world. Plus, we'll talk about what we and the wider world are reading. This is the Book Review Podcast from the New York Times. It's January 8th. I'm Pamela Paul. Charles Yu joins us now from Irvine, California. His latest novel is Interior Chinatown. It just won the National Book Award for Fiction. Charles, thanks for being here.
Thank you, Pamela. I'm excited to be here.
And let's start with that winning the National Book Award. Your speech was so great. I just loved it because you seemed genuinely surprised. I don't know. What was that moment like for you?
I was genuinely surprised. I was screaming, you know, as they were sort of reading the citation, my family and I, we were all sort of looking at each other and just yelling, and we didn't know what to do. And my son, after a while, said, I think you need to give a speech. And so I sort of pulled myself together, but I didn't really, because then I proceeded to forget to thank my wife, my kids, and my parents. So half of whom were in the room with me. It was just awful.
You know, there's a fine tradition, though, I think, of leaving like the most important people out in acceptance speeches.
I hope so.
I don't know. Do you think it would have been different if it had been in real life? I guess it must have been nice to, even if you forgot to thank them, at least have all those people, those close family members in the room with you.
I mean, one of the weird, unexpected, I guess, benefits of having a virtual ceremony was that we got to hug each other immediately after and then change back into shorts and have pizza.
Why didn't you think you'd win? I mean, the chances are pretty good when there are, you know, only a certain number of finalists.
That's true. I suppose I maybe underestimated the chances a little bit, but I don't know. It just seems like something that happens to other people.
Well, it happened to you, I think deservedly so. This is your fourth book of fiction, and they all have really amazing titles, which I'm going to read aloud. And then I'd love you to just sort of walk us through them before we talk about this latest novel, Interior Chinatown. So the titles are Third Class Superhero, How to Live Safely in a Science Fictional Universe, and Sorry, Please, Thank You, which is a collection of stories. I mean, just those titles.
Thanks. I do enjoy titles. I wish there were a job where you could just title things. Maybe I'll try to make up that job. I don't know what that would be exactly. But yeah, it's fun. It helps me both, I think, sometimes have a handle on what I'm trying to do. And also, I just imagine when somebody encounters that title, I'm hoping that they get that feeling of, oh, I want to flip to that page and see, what is that?
You know, it's funny when you say like you wish you could have a job coming up with titles. I feel like I have to bring up the fact that writing fiction is not your first job. It's not your only job, that you started off as a corporate lawyer. How did you get from that life to this one?
Well, it took a while. I graduated from law school in 2001. And as I was supposed to be studying for the bar, I found myself in the bookstore instead, reading George Saunders and Laurie Moore and people like that, and just kind of diving into the world of, I guess, contemporary fiction at that time, and just getting really excited about it. And I think also procrastinating from studying. And so then I started to write these sort of weird, you know, the first thing I wrote was a love story that is a set of physics problems like that you would find in an undergraduate physics textbook. And I just thought, well, I don't know what this is, but it's something to do, you know, on nights and weekends when I'm, you know, waiting for waiting for the senior associate to tell me all the things I did wrong in my merger agreement. So it was just this sort of thing I was doing on the side for many years. And somehow I was creeping towards this TV land without even realizing it, because a few years ago I was at work. I was at the time working in-house for a tech company as a lawyer, and I got a call to come meet for a potential spot on the writing staff of this show, Westworld. And I thought, well, this is not going to happen. But somehow they hired me. So that was a few years ago. And that's what I've been doing since as my day job.
So it's not just Westworld. You also have worked on this show, Legion, and Lodge 49. What's the difference between writing for TV for you and writing your own fiction?
It's been a bit of a steep learning curve for me. I think one big difference is that TV is a very collaborative activity. And so it's fun in a way that I had not expected, when an idea sort of ping-pongs around, you know, other people and comes back around, and you sort of get to play in that team sport. It's an activity probably closer to collaborating at any number of jobs, right? Creative or not. And then I think, you know, a big part of being on staff is learning to write for the show, the vision of somebody else, and also just what is the show becoming as the writing progresses. You're trying to aim for a target that's not necessarily inside of your own voice. Whereas with fiction, you have, you know, the autonomy, but also the responsibility, you know, of coming up with everything yourself.
Speaking of autonomy, did you go from being a corporate lawyer and writing on the side to working in TV and writing on the side? Or was there a period in the middle where you were like just doing your own thing?
There was supposed to be. That was the plan. My wife and I had talked for years, and she's always really pushed me to try to take time to figure out what I was doing, especially with this latest book. This book took almost 7 years, depending on how you count it. And for a lot of that, I was extremely kind of lost in the woods. And there were points where I actually tried to give up, and she talked me off the ledge and said, what are you doing? You know, I was sort of like roll around on the floor and having sort of a mini tantrum. And she just like, get up, you know, what's going on? And so actually at one point, I had thought of leaving the job that I was at the time just to take a few months off and try to finish the book. And so that was the plan. And so I had talked to my then boss about leaving. And instead, I got this call to come work on a TV show. And of course, having kids and needing health insurance, I wasn't going to turn down a job. But I did end up just going from one day job to another day job. So it wasn't until a couple of years ago that, after working on shows like Lodge 49 and Legion, I started to think, well, I really do need to find a way to take some time and try to finish this book. So I did that, trying to forego working in a writer's room for a while and so that I could really focus on this 100% for a while.
All right. I know I'm not supposed to be shocked at the fact that this book took you so long when it reads so easily, but I am still shocked, like, because this is a book that, for those who haven't read it, you're immediately sucked right into it. What was it that took so long? Was part of it the form? Because the form, of course, is very specific. It's done in the form of a TV script.
Yes, it was the form. I think I had the stuff in the bag, but I didn't have the bag, you know? And to me, or maybe it's more like a box. Maybe this goes back to my love of titles. I think a framework helps me understand what I'm doing. Otherwise, it's just a bunch of stuff for a long time. And that's what it was. And that stuff, you know, kind of, I don't know what, I'm getting lost in my metaphors here, but if it's Play-Doh, you know, it started to get that point in the Play-Doh where you're like, I don't want this Play-Doh anymore. This is getting really messy and it's got my fingerprints all over it. And that's all I can see is how much I've sort of ruined it. And multiply that by 3-4 years. And I really was like, I don't know what this is anymore. And after kind of doing that for a while, / working in TV at the same time, I think the screenplay format presented itself. And I thought, well, even though this seems pretty out there, I have to try this because this is the first thing that has felt really right.
I'm going to go back to your original metaphor. So the bag is the TV script, and we'll get to that because I'm fascinated by it. But let's start with the stuff in the bag. Like, what was it that you set out to write about in this novel? And this, I think, will help people who haven't read the book sort of get a sense of what it is about.
On the straightforward level, it's about a guy named Willis Wu, whose job at the beginning of the story is to be generic Asian man number 3/ delivery guy, meaning he's basically a background player in a kind of police procedural called Black and White. And what Willis really dreams of being is Kung Fu guy, which is the highest level he can attain being an Asian actor. So it's, you know, the story of Willis and his family, and sort of in a lot of ways, it's his growth as, you know, as a character and as into somebody who believes that he has his own story.
Presumably before you came up with the bag, the TV script, you were doing this as a kind of straight narrative.
Yes. I think I had a period of time where I thought straight narrative, get serious. You know, you've written a time travel story. You've written a bunch of short stories that have maybe sort of cool titles, but, you know, like write something serious so people will take you seriously. And that, of course, was a bad idea because nothing.
That's like how not to win the National Book Award, it turns out.
I did not know what I was doing. I tried, and then I tried forms that I could say probably basically orbit around like magical realism. I think that was the idea I had for a long time, that somehow the process of assimilation and coming to America, you know, was this sort of new land. I thought, well, there's magic there, you know, both light and dark, and there's something interesting there. But I didn't know what I was doing with that. So that never took either.
I feel like that could still be the next book. That there's an idea still in there. But this one is done as a TV script down to the font, to the typeface. Actually, I don't know how they do that with an ebook version of it, but in the book version, it looks exactly like a TV script. And I'm curious if you insisted that it be this way from the get-go. Like, did you have trouble persuading others that no, it's gotta look this way?
I didn't have as much trouble as I thought, because the book is published by Pantheon, and they, among other things, publish really beautiful books. They put a lot of care, I think, into the actual object. And I had an anxiety from the moment I realized, oh, to do this right, it should probably be in Courier font, even though personally, you know, I love Courier font for screenplays, for its ease of reading. And I loved it as an undergrad when I could, you know, pad the length of my essays using Courier font, but it's not the prettiest thing to look at. And I thought, are people going to want to read that? But my editor, Tim O'Connell there, and other people there, I think I never actually encountered any resistance. I think we just thought it has to be this, and we got to commit to the bit, I guess.
Do you think of interior Chinatown as letting people into that world of being an Asian American in this country, and specifically in the world of Hollywood?
I hope so. I think that was the original thing that got me excited to tell the story this way, was to give life, interior life, subjective consciousness to someone who normally doesn't get that treatment. And Willis is an Asian American, and specifically an Asian American man who, for most of my life growing up, you know, you didn't see a whole lot of that kind of person on the screen. And if you did, it was usually in one of these very few prescribed roles. And they were often as props, you know, they were a punchline or fulfilling a very specific role, like here's your food. So I think that writing a character like that, starting from the inside, was very exciting. And in addition to being Asian American, you know, and viewed as background Asian guy, Willis also is a son and eventually sort of, you know, a romantic partner and a kind of pseudo parent. And, you know, these are all roles that I think he has to grow into to some degree in the story. So I was interested in all of the ways that someone can feel like, oh, I'm doing this now. You know, am I equipped for this? And where's the instruction manual? Where's my script? You know, and you know, I hope it has some of those dimensions as well.
Willis Wu, your protagonist, is obviously a character. He's an actor in front of the camera on a TV show. You are an Asian American writer working behind the scenes on several TV shows. I mean, do you think about the way in which you are creating character and specifically around ethnicity and ethnic stereotypes in your own work?
I do think about that. You know, this book really grew out of a, I don't know if grew out of is the right way to put it, but years ago, after actually I had published my second book, How to Live Safely, at a reading, I think it was in Boston, someone came up to me afterward and said they had liked the book, but just sincerely asked, why are you covering up your writing about race and immigration? This is clearly an immigrant story, but you seem to be writing about it in a somewhat coded way. And that really stuck with me. So note to anyone who attends readings and says really incisive, pointed things to authors, like, be careful, because you might spin them out for 10 years. But this book was me trying to write something that both I felt like I had the tools to write. You know, I wasn't going to sit down and write serious literature novel, you know, that just apparently isn't in my skill set. But I was looking for a way to extend what I had done before, but also make a break with it at the same time, if that makes sense.
While many people maybe are coming to this book at this moment for the first time, it obviously just won the National Book Award. It's in paperback, so people are coming to it now. But you obviously finished this a while ago, and it came out in January of 2020, which feels like, you know, I don't know if it feels like a century ago to you, but it sort of feels that way to me. So you must be working on something new. What are you working on now?
I am working on a few things, one of which is the adaptation of this for Hulu, who I am lucky enough to work with, and really excited, but really daunted by the challenge, because I think there was a, as discussed, that finding the bag that contained this stuff, you know, in book form was one thing. I think I need to find a new bag for the screen version of it. And so that'll be the challenge.
All right. Well, here's to finding that bag. Charles, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks, Pamela.
The latest book by Charles Yu is Interior Chinatown, which just won the National Book Award for Fiction.
Tumi has a soft side. Discover their new Azra bag collection and its pillowy pleats, satin finish, and crescent shape. Azra is the bag to carry for your 9-to-5 and your 5-to-9 plans that follow. Versatility, after all, is Tumi's signature. Shop the full Azra collection on Tumi.com or at a Tumi store near you.
My name is Thomas Gibbsneff. I'm a journalist at the New York Times. I served in the Marine Corps as an infantryman. When it comes to reporting on the front line, a lot of the same basics are at play. You're looking at the map of where you're going. If you're on a paved road, field roads, you know, is there a hospital nearby? Is your body armor affixed with a first aid kit? Does everyone know where that first aid kit is? We arrive into a military position. I get out of the car. I look at my watch. You know, I set a timer, no more than an hour. I'm listening for drones, jets, check in with the team. Is everyone comfortable? And if they are, then we proceed. Frontline reporting is dangerous, but I think nothing is more important than talking to the people involved, you know, hearing their stories and being able to connect that with people thousands of miles away. Anything that can make something like this more personal, I think, is well worth the risk. New York Times subscribers make it possible for us to keep doing this vital coverage. If you'd like to subscribe, you can do that at nytimes.com/subscribe.
So here's a request for our listeners. I get lots of feedback from you, some complaints, lots of kind words. Really appreciate it. You can always reach me directly at books@nytimes.com. I will write back. But you can also, if you feel moved to do so, review us on any platform where you download the podcast, whether that's iTunes or Stitcher or Google Play or somewhere else. Please feel free to review us and, of course, email us at any time. David S. Brown joins us now from Lancaster County, Pennsylvania, to talk about his newest book. It's called The Last American Aristocrat, The Brilliant Life and Improbable Education of Henry Adams. David, thanks for being here.
Good to be with you.
So you've written biographies of Richard Hofstadter, F. Scott Fitzgerald, and Thomas Jefferson, and now, of course, Henry Adams. How do you choose your biographical subjects?
You know, these are all labors of love. These are individuals that I'm pretty intensely interested in. You need to be, because this is going to have to carry with you for several years. I began the Adams Project in April of 2012, so it's been about 8 years. So there's something about these individuals, their lives, their work, their intellectual interests, that always draw me in and keep me pushing for a long time.
On the surface, they seem like very different figures. Richard Hofstadter, an historian, F. Scott Fitzgerald, of course, novelist, Thomas Jefferson, a president, and Henry Adams, a writer. But they were all writers. And I'm curious if that was one of the things about them that drew you to them.
I think it was. And more broadly, they were all thinkers. They were all intellectuals. And so I'm a historian of the United States. And all these individuals, in their works, they thought about, they ruminated on, and they wrote about their country at different times. So in one sense, they come from separate times, discrete areas, corners of the country. But in another sense, they really helped to embody, you know, some of the major ideas that have circulated around this country, whether it be American politics personified in literature, which you find a little bit with someone like F. Scott Fitzgerald, or with Henry Adams, who wrote poetry, who wrote a couple of novels, American history, and then this memoir, right, The Education of Henry Adams. All these works sort of meditated on what it meant to be an American at a time of deep and great change. And I think all these individuals that I've been interested in, they've embodied that curiosity to some extent.
What was it specifically about Henry Adams that drew you? And why now? I mean, you started, as you said, in 2012.
So I was attracted to him, I think, when I was in graduate school. He just kept popping up on reading lists and books that I was reading outside of my coursework. And I finally dug into The Education of Henry Adams and his approach to thinking about change, not just in the United States, but around the world. It was very attractive to me. One of the things that he talked about was the speed up of historical time and the industrial process and how this industrial process was giving us these wonderful things, but it was also taking some things away. We were losing our sense of spirituality, and we were transferring it to a new form of spirituality, one embodied by what he called the dynamo of industrial development. And there was this wonderful story he gave, how in 1900, he walked into a building, the Great Gallery of Machines at the French Expo. He saw this man standing in front of this machine. As he said, Henry said, people used to stand before the cross with wonder, with awe, before silence and infinite force. And so this notion of us transferring our old spiritual self into a new spiritual self, industrialization, technology, that Adam said we can really not control. It's going to control us. I found that all quite provocative. And so to look around and see how we use appropriate technology today, to see how in some respects it really dominates us, it makes me think of Henry Adams and The Education. And I think that that's what drew me in about 20 years ago.
Aristocrats are obviously not very popular types during these very populist times. So it's a kind of curious thing to look at who were these last aristocrats of a kind. I mean, I'm assuming that somewhat explains your title.
That's right. For Henry Adams, the early American history was filled with deferential types. More deference than democracy. And he could see this breaking down. And in some respects, he was just fine with this. In other respects, though, he railed against it, and he thought it was going to be a sort of a smash-up for the country. It's not the first time that even an Adams had sort of come to this point of perspective. In the 1820s, Andrew Jackson became president, and he defeated Henry's grandfather, John Quincy Adams. And you could find in Adams' correspondence this sort of marinating over what does this mean exactly, you know, for the country, for the broader perspective here, what will be the ultimate course of populism in America, which, as you suggested, is a question that still is very much with us today.
Let's talk a little bit more about Henry Adams's family. You mentioned, of course, John Quincy Adams, his grandfather, who was the president, but of course, his great-grandfather, John Adams, was president before him. Tell us a little bit more about the Adams family and the status of that family when Henry Adams was born in 1838.
So this was America's most distinguished quasi-aristocratic family. And for Henry and his brothers as well, it was a bit crippling. Crippling in the sense that the times had changed. No longer could an Emerson, no longer could an Adams be a quote-unquote representative man of the Republic. Populism industrialization, machine politics had taken over after the American Civil War. And so Henry could not just expect, by dint of his education, by dint of his talents and his writings, to be given a position in government. He would have to hustle for it. He would have to work for it. And he complained in The Education of Henry Adams that his education was a failed education because it did not equip him to be like that. He meant this ironically, because the education of a hustler was not really an education that he wanted. So he was speaking critically of what the Republic had become. So he embraced his Adams legacy, but in some respects, he thought that it worked against his prospects. And so one can't help but wonder, when he decides to leave Quincy, leave Boston, and come and live primarily in the nation's capital, in the South, which he oftentimes associated with his grandmother, not a grandmother Adams, but on the other side, who was London by birth, but her family came from Maryland, a Southern family. If he was not trying to slip the grip of the Adamses and carve out something a little bit different for himself, not as a politician, but as a writer and a thinker.
His father, though, the rules still operated for his father, Charles Francis Adams, right? I mean, he was a vice presidential candidate. He was a diplomat.
And not just a diplomat, but he was at the court of St. James's, which is where three generations of Adamses have performed public service. So it was there. And there was still this reflexive pull in the Adams family into the 1870s that perhaps Charles Francis would find his way back to the White House, where he had lived in his youth when his father was president. That mechanical pull was still in the family up until about the 1870s.
Henry Adams was the third son in his family, correct?
That's right.
And so did that play a part, too, in his sort of feeling like, you know, maybe he wasn't the designated heir to this political dynasty?
Yes, it did. He was named Henry Adams after his mother's deceased brother. And he was not named Charles, like his second brother, named after the father, or John Quincy, named after, of course, John Quincy. So there was this freedom that he thought he had to maneuver, to play around a bit. He liked to refer to himself as a third son. And for him, that gave him an opportunity, if there was a chance, to maybe find his way into public service, maybe be the fourth Adams to serve at the court of St. James's in London. But if not, to be able to say it was not meant to be by birth.
When someone writes a book called The Education of Henry Adams, you kind of have to ask really specifically about that education, not just his formal education, but I'm assuming he's speaking more broadly about his upbringing.
That's right. Formal education, it does play a role in that he would say Harvard was Latin, Harvard was Greek, Harvard was the past education, and it didn't really equip me to do what young men of my generation were going to do after the Civil War. But certainly, more broadly, this education, the cultural education, the political education, which he called colonial. You know, I was born a colonial child. He was born in 1838, but sometimes he referred to himself as an 18th century child, not a 19th century child, because the education, he said, it was backward and it was primitive. Now, again, he's being somewhat ironic here because he sees a value in the humanities, in the arts, in these so-called dead languages. But what he's saying is that how unfortunate it is that Gilded Age America, which is so interested in building railroads and moving and pushing and building, but maybe not thinking or reflecting, that we've lost some of our capacity to aspire to something higher than this.
How did he end up becoming a writer?
I think that was in the blood. The Adamses were noted diarists, keeper of daybooks. They kept chronicles, journals. And so this was just something that I think was always in the household. You know, he lived for a period of time with his grandfather, John Quincy Adams. And John Quincy Adams' diary, which he kept every day, is one of the great documents we have of the early Republic. And so Henry would have seen this. He would have been around this milieu. And he also helped to edit his grandfather and his great-grandfather's letters. He assisted his father doing this when he was a teenager. So this is just what an Adams did. And Adams read and wrote.
Among the things he wrote, he did write for the New York Times. What kinds of writing did he do for this paper?
He wanted to be useful. And so when it looks like the country is going to divide, this is the secessionist winter of 1860-61, he's working for his father's secretary, and his father's a congressman. So Henry's in Washington. And Henry is sending these, you know, kind of dispatches back. And he's supposed to be basically just, you know, kind of, well, reporting facts, reporting truth. But he's really kind of gilding the lily here on hope, on optimism. And he's saying, you know, what's happening here is that, you know, some great compromise is going to happen because of the compromise of 1820, because of the compromise of 1850, because his father was a personage who was looking for compromise here. And so Henry was from time to time fantasizing. And he knew that he was doing this. He thought that he was performing a service, I think, that went beyond mere editorial work or writing for a newspaper. But he was beginning to, I think, sort of feel himself and his responsibility, an obligation as an Adams to help the country, to push it through this time. And he thought that he was doing that by trying to inform readers that all would be well, when, of course, we know that all would not be well.
Presumably, that sense of mission was behind the writing of history that he also did, primarily of the Jeffersonian and Madison eras and administration. So you've written a biography of Thomas Jefferson. How accurate was Henry Adams's history of that period? How good a historian was he?
He was, I think, the best American historian of the 19th century. And the book is in print. I see from time to time references to it, contemporary references to it. It's terribly readable. On most factual counts, he's on the money. Where it doesn't hold up as well, and we might guess this, he primarily wrote this in the 1870s and 1880s, is tonally. So his observations on race, his observations on gender, predictably are not where ours are today. The great advantage he had was being an Adams and being a bit of an aristocrat. He could go to European archives that were closed to mere mortals, and he could get access, he can get in. And so his, for example, his observations and his ability to get letters out of British archives regarding the Aaron Burr affair, when, you know, Burr was sort of thinking about, well, you know, maybe I'll carve off a kind of kingdom for myself. It's still a little bit esoteric to this day what exactly Burr was up to. But Henry is quoting from British ministers who had direct conversation with Aaron Burr. And no one had had access to these papers before. And when I read this for the first time, maybe about 20 years ago, it was illuminating to me. So clear and so direct were these comments. And his work is really peppered with that. And so aside from just being a tremendous story about historical developments in the American Republic from roughly, 1800 to 1860, he's got this original observation about America developing into something that it never thought it was going to be, and approaching this topic with a little bit of trepidation. Again, hearkening back before he even thought about this notion of an American dynamo, but hearkening back to the idea that America was moving towards something that it could not control. And I think that that was really his great gift. He was not simply writing out of an archive, but he was thinking about the archives, and he was thinking about the America that he was living in, and he was making original, thoughtful observations.
You mentioned his views on race and gender. He was also, of course, anti-Semitic and prejudiced against Irish Catholics. How typical were those for his time and class and background? And to what extent were they maybe exceptionally awful?
So he was fairly typical, particularly when you mentioned class. He was fairly typical for the Boston Brahmin type. If he was, as you put it, exceptional, it's that I think he went even beyond the typical Brahmin. I think he did this for a couple of reasons. One is, if you look at the Adams family and some of those New England families, there was a bit of intermarriage. There was a bit of clannishness. Then if you add the pressures of belonging to a great political family, I think in Henry and his younger brother, Brooks in particular, I think that there was some anxiety that went beyond, typical. And I think that that colored and that reflected their outlook on the world. They were gloomy, or they could be gloomy and negative about all kinds of things. And that would include these rising ethnic groups, which they thought were going to replace them. So this is an inelegant side of Adams that we see in other Brahmins, but I think there's something in his own emotional framework and his response to his environment, particularly in the 1890s when there was a financial panic which hit the country pretty hard, and the Adams Financial Trust also. Henry sort of reflexively fell back upon an economic anti-Semitism, and he rode that pretty hard. So the anti-Semitism was there. It was most pronounced, I think, in the 1890s.
Our reviewer of this book referred to Henry Adams, described him as bitter and thoroughly unlikable. Is that a fair assessment to your mind?
I think that the reviewer did a great job in covering quite a few aspects of Adams' life, because that's really what a really good reviewer does, can cover more than just the book. Personally, there's a mischievous and a playful side, and also a bit of a tragic side to Henry Adams that draws me in as well. So there is certainly the bitter quotient, that is there, but that's all that was there. I wouldn't have spent 8 years on this man's life, because that would have driven me away. His letters are incredible, and the way that he can open himself up and show glimpses of what he thought to be the tragic side of his heritage, and to do it in not really a self-pitying way, but a reflective way. That really is quite interesting. It's an attribute that most of us want to have, but the honesty, that can be difficult. So when I see Henry Adams, I see a very emotionally complex individual, someone who shows a range of attributes and emotions, and someone who is also a seeker. And I think seekers are always attractive. So this is somebody who in his 50s was going around the world, like a 14-month trip, visiting places like Fiji and Samoa and spending months at these places and searching for something, looking to find answers, sometimes to questions that I think that he had only half formulated. And that type of, not just intellectual drive, but that type of emotional searching, I think is also part of his makeup.
One last question. We've talked about some of his books, some of his historical works, his memoir, his journalism, his essays, not so much about his travel writing or his fiction. If you had to recommend one book of his that really sort of stands up today or that bears a look at, which one would you recommend?
His first novel, Democracy, which came out in 1880, it's delicious and it still holds up. It's a shot across the bow of American democracy. It's witty, it's funny, and the impulse behind it, which is to be respectful of our institutions, but also to hold our elected leaders up to high standards in the best of all possible worlds. I think that's still a good notion. The book is very readable today. I think you can just dive in. And you can't say that about all 19th century novels written by Americans.
All right. Well, you add two books to our piles of books to be read, Democracy, and of course, your own book. The title again is The Last American Aristocrat, The Brilliant Life and Improbable Education of Henry Adams by David Brown. David, thanks again for being here.
Good to be with you.
Alexandra Alter joins us now with some news from the publishing world. Hey, Alexandra.
Hi, Pamela.
So we're going to do something a little bit different, or rather, it's similar to something that we did last month, which was our questions from listeners episode. And unfortunately, we didn't get a chance to get to some questions that listeners had. I think that you could answer probably better than anyone else. So I would love to just return to a couple of questions from listeners about the book business.
Perfect.
All right.
Let's do it.
Here we go. This one is from Maria Costigan from Washington, D.C. She says, I have been trying desperately to support my local bookshops over the past few months. I've also recently returned home to spend time with my sister and mother and realized they have both turned into e-reader people. I would love to buy them ebook gift cards for holiday gifts, but I don't know how to do that without going through Amazon. Is there a way to purchase gift cards through a platform like bookshop.org? I've done some Googling, but not finding anything obvious, and I thought perhaps your other podcast listeners would have similar questions this month. Well, it's obviously not December and gift-giving time for the holidays anymore, but it's a good question for any time. So over to you, Alexandra.
Yeah, it is a great question. And it's a tricky one because I think, as our listeners know, Amazon really has close to a monopoly on the ebook business because of their Kindle device, because it's seamlessly integrated with their website. But there are ways to buy ebooks from indie bookstores. Kobo is another ebook maker that a lot of indies use as their way to provide ebooks that people buy from them to people's devices. And there's another site, Hummingbird, where you can also buy ebooks from indies. So there are ways. It just helps to have an e-reading device, or you can even use an app on your phone probably for Kobo. So it's something that I think a lot of people are doing more during the pandemic and shutdown because it's an easy way to get books. And if you want to get them not from Amazon, as some people do, they want to support their local independents, there's definitely ways to do that with Kobo and Hummingbird. It's also easy to get audiobooks through other means than Audible. Audible is owned by Amazon, and they, again, have a very stronghold on the audiobook industry because they have this app. It's very convenient, and you know that's a good way to listen. But if you really want to support independence or find other ways to get your audiobooks, Libro.fm is a great source for audiobooks that supports independent bookstores. So those are two good resources for people that are interested in getting their books digitally, but maybe want to do it through indies. And of course, you can look on your independent store's website to see how they are offering those digital formats.
All right. Here is another question from the very opposite end of the publishing industry, coming from someone who is an aspiring book author. So this is from Amber Worthy. And she says that she's a journalist who tells stories for a living. And she said, the thought of sending my amazing story out hundreds of times scares me. So she sent her story/book proposal/query maybe 4 or 5 times. What she asks is, what protections are there to keep agents from just finding someone else to tell the story or to take the premise and make it their own? I know they can't steal it 100%, but they could try, right? At least my brain believes that. So, Alexander, you've looked into questions around intellectual property, and I think we get some variation of this kind of question from a lot of aspiring writers who just think, like, how well am I protected here?
Yeah, no, it's an excellent question. And even though it's an obvious one, it wasn't one I'd ever investigated or really probed before. So I asked a very well-known and well-established literary agent, Richard Pine, what he thought of this question. You know, when you send out your idea to a bunch of agents, there's not any kind of law that prevents them from saying, wow, I love this idea, but I'm going to give it to this other writer. But there is a very strong norm, I suppose you could say, that, you know, it's a business that is built on people's reputations. And so as a literary agent, essentially what Richard Pine said is this almost never happens. It would be very unusual and very out of school for a literary agent to take a particular idea that they got on submission and hand it over to a different writer. Word would get around. And it's really an honor code, I think, that's just simply not done or tolerated. And, you know, he said he has seen ideas ripped off, you know, a couple of times in his long career, and it didn't go well for the people involved. So essentially, there's not a real, you know, unless it's something that the author has experienced themselves and they have kind of life rights to it. If it's more of a general topic of nonfiction, there's a good chance that someone else might be working on something similar. But as far as an agent taking a specific idea and handing it off, that would be considered extremely poor form. The word would get out and people wouldn't be eager to do business with that agent again.
All right. I hope that soothes your worries, Amber.
Yes. Good luck with the project, Amber. I hope that you're able to get it out and get it published.
Alexandra, thanks so much.
Thanks so much. And thanks for the questions there. It's always great to hear from our listeners.
Joining us now to talk about what we're reading, my colleagues Andrew LaValle and John Williams. Hey, guys.
Hi, Pamela.
Andrew, let's start with you. What are you reading this week?
I have been reading Just Like You by Nick Hornby. It is
set in London, clearly in 2016, and it's about a 40-something white school teacher named Lucy and a black 22-year-old named Joseph. They meet at the local butcher. Lucy hires him to babysit for her teenage boys, and they eventually become romantically involved. But their sort of relationship is complicated by the differences in race, age, education, and class. And it's all playing out with the Brexit vote looming.
And how are you liking it?
I'm liking it. And something I like about it in particular is that it's a romance and about sort of their ups and downs. And something I like is that their differences aren't just about race. It's also about the generational divide between them and differences in who their friends are and what they like to do. There's this scene where Joseph, who is an aspiring music producer, is playing a track that he's working on for Lucy. And she starts kind of bobbing along in this way that's sort of like, she likes it the way that a supportive mom would like it. And he like is horrified and goes and locks himself in the bathroom. And so there's a couple of like funny scenes like that.
I was about to ask if it's funny because it's Hornby, and I guess it is.
Yeah. John, what are you reading?
I just finished reading a book called The Watchtower, a novel by Elizabeth Harrower, an Australian writer. About 6 years ago, James Wood wrote a piece in The New Yorker about her sort of rediscovering her novels because Text Publishing, a house in Australia, had reissued her novels, which were written in the 60s and early 70s, I believe. She actually died earlier this year at 92, but she hadn't written for decades. She gave it up after this fourth novel, The Watchtower, came out. And only a few years ago did the publisher convince her to take an unfound manuscript and reissue it finally, that she had written right after The Watchtower, and that's called In Certain Circles. The Watchtower is a book about two sisters, Laura and Claire, and they're abandoned by their mother who goes to live in Europe. They're in Sydney. And Laura goes to work at a factory for a man named Felix Shaw. And as she and her younger sister Claire get a bit older, Laura decides to marry Felix when he asks her to, in a very almost hilariously unromantic scene where she basically says, sure, I'll do it for the stability. And he says, great, nobody else is asking you. And so that's the seed that you can imagine does not grow into a very healthy marriage or relationship. Felix is a very controlling, ill-tempered person. When he drinks too much, he comes home sort of raging and violent. And as Claire gets older, she starts to be more dissatisfied than Laura is. Claire, for me, is the truly unforgettable character in this book. Laura makes a lot of rationalizations about why she's with Felix, doing the right thing for the family and for her sister. And so in a way, even though she sees the bad behavior, you never get the sense that she's going to break away from it. And Claire, the central drama of the book becomes whether Claire is going to break away from this three-person, you know, very unhealthy relationship, and whether or not she will convince her sister Laura to do the same and come with her. I wouldn't call it a psychological thriller because thriller is too loaded a word, and people who hear that will be disappointed when they read it. But there is this kind of unrelenting psychological tension throughout the book, leavened occasionally with some dark humor, a lot of great description. She is, as I think Wood called her, a complexly polished writer. The prose is both a little odd at times because it's very much her own style, but something you fall into and that I always wanted to return to while I was reading the book. The consensus around these things is not always correct, but this is widely considered, I think, to be her best book. But I'm still eager to read the rest because it was so good. So I think even if the rest aren't quite up to this level, they'll be more than worth it. So I've got a couple of more on their way to my to my house. Pamela, what have you been reading these days?
Well, I recently finished the latest book by David Nassau, who's probably best known to readers as the biographer of Joseph Kennedy, and he also wrote an excellent biography of Andrew Carnegie. The book that I read is called The Last Million. The subtitle is Europe's Displaced Persons from World War to Cold War. I will say, he is an excellent narrative storyteller, and the Carnegie biography, of course, Carnegie had this incredible, you know, rags to opulent riches life, sort of, you know, made for biography. It was really great. I didn't actually finish that book yet because at the time I was reading it, I was pregnant with my third child. And when it came time to go to the hospital, like, I just couldn't lug along like that huge biography. So
there,
I
there are
ended
books
up
that I won't lug along to the park.
So I ended up reading The Hunger Games instead, which is probably also like inappropriate. But in any case, I do intend to go back to that. This book is not really narrative. It's definitive. You get the sense that David Nassau really wanted someone to get this story down and to really document it, and that he does. And it is a really interesting and important story. I would say the big picture story is that we get the sense, you know, in general, as like, I don't know, presumably lay people of history, that when a war ends, you know, it's over and everyone gets to go home and people are saved and people are mourned. But of course, it's much messier than that. And it was especially messy at the end of World War II, because the international community, such as it existed, was nascent and disorganized, as it would be after any war. But, you know, there isn't an established record of international cooperation at this stage. And also, it's the beginning of the Cold War. So the people who were, or the countries that were just allies, are now already becoming enemies. And in Germany, what happened was that at the end of the war, there were many people there who didn't belong there, and the vast majority of them went home or they moved elsewhere. They immigrated. But there were this last million that really didn't have anywhere to go, either because the place they had been no longer existed, or they refused to return to that place because that place had so changed or was so unwelcome to them that it wouldn't have been a refuge, but would have probably meant imprisonment or death. And for many, many different reasons, because the group left in Germany was so varied. So just to give you a sense, of course, you have the survivors of the Holocaust, the concentration camps, the labor camps who are there. And of course, we all have seen the photographs of when, you know, Buchenwald and other camps were liberated. And you think, oh, yes, and they all went home. But of course, that wasn't actually the case. They were there. They stayed there, often in those very same camps or in other camps, for years in many cases. You know, this was before the founding of Israel in 1948. This is actually a very interesting companion book, I would say, to read alongside Dean Acheson's memoir, Present at the Creation, which kind of deals with a lot of this same period, or part of that memoir does. So there isn't an Israel to go to. And despite the fact that everyone is horrified by what's happened, or many countries and people are horrified by what happened in the Holocaust, there's still worldwide persistent anti-Semitism. And, you know, everyone sort of says, like, oh, yes, the Jews must be taken, but not by us, by this person or this country. And so there's this really ugly absence of generosity and empathy toward that population. And the Jews themselves, you know, if they didn't want to go to Israel, but one interesting thing is they didn't all want to go to Israel. There was a secular Jewish political organization that was based in Poland and Latvia called the Bund, which was a kind of working class Jewish organization that was ideologically socialist, but not communist, and strongly opposed to Zionism. So, you know, there, it wasn't even uniform among the Jews, although the majority of them did want to go to Israel. Above all, they didn't want to go back to Poland, which was perceived as very anti-Semitic, and willing collaborators. And then, speaking of collaborators, there were many collaborators in Germany who had been from the Baltic states, you know, from Latvia, from Lithuania, from Estonia, people who had willingly collaborated with the Nazis and now knew that if they returned to those Baltic states, which were under the influence of the Red Army, that they would be seen as traitors. So they didn't want to go back either. And then again, further complicating it, you had many Germans who were Nazis, who were actively part of Hitler's regime, who sort of, you know, threw off all of their Nazi accoutrements and burned their papers and pretended to be victims of one sort or another. And there proceeded to be a complex series of policies that were enacted to try to deal with this population, to get them to various countries. At one point, there were advertising campaigns for countries to hire them as workers, countries whose populations had been depleted, you know, their population of labor had been depleted during the war, to go in and hire these people. But again, you know, there's just this really ugly underside, because the people who were hired were the least needy. They were the most able-bodied. They were the healthiest ones. So they were sort of plucked out first. And then really terrible things happened where, of course, people either knowingly had former collaborators and war criminals took them in, either knowingly or sort of, you know, turning a blind eye to what was all but obvious. And many of them had the underarm tattoo of the Chode. You know, all you had to do was look really to see if they had been part of the Nazi party. So that's the history that he tells in this book. And it's told in a largely chronological way that I wouldn't say it's totally riveting reading. The subject is so fascinating and the details and the complexities are so interesting. And then, of course, there are all of the parallels that you can draw to today with any refugee crisis, that when there are people who don't have a home, there really is still no process for dealing with what everyone recognizes is a moral issue and a practical issue and a problem for many countries. Still, for people who don't have a country, it's no country's problem.
I'm always a little intimidated to read histories that big because, like you said, that the Acheson would be a good complimentary read. I always worry about just feeling like now there are 500 more books that I should read around that subject.
Yeah.
You know, I talked a few podcasts ago about Lawrence in Arabia by Scott Anderson. And that period, you know, that book dealt with World War I in the Middle East. And so there's definitely a book or two in between if you're looking at the Middle East that I sort of now are my missing holes to kind of fill it in. But I would recommend this. I would definitely recommend, if you haven't read it, the Dean Acheson memoir, which I think is, I don't know, you know, if Grant is the great presidential memoir, this is the great Secretary of State memoir, to my mind. Really interesting book.
It's interesting, too, to just think about, like, aftermaths and how much story there is still there, even after, you know, we think of World War II as being this big victory and then it's kind of done.
Yes. Yeah. You know, in journalism, they always talk about sort of the TikTok, you know, the leading up to the event after the event has passed. And I'm always interested in the story after the story, you know, like what happened to the missing child who was found. Let's go back 5 years later and sort of what happened after that. So this book kind of fit in perfectly with that reader's impulse. Andrew, John, let's run down the titles again.
I'm reading Just Like You by Nick Hornby.
And I read The Watchtower by Elizabeth Harrower.
And I read The Last Million by David Nassau. Remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. And you can always write to us at books@nytimes.com. I write back, not right away, but I do. The Book Review Podcast is produced by the great Pedro Rosado from Headstepper Media, with a major assist from my colleague John Williams. Thanks for listening. For The New York Times, I'm Pamela Paul.
If your family's like mine, they've got a lot going on. Help them manage with new cognitive health supplements for kids. New lollipops help kids focus on homework or chill out for a sec. Get lollipops at Olly.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.